Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. Thank you very much for your donations to the podcast. Just in time for Shavuot, we're completing our spring fundraising campaign. You can donate online at any time via donate.pardesusa.org. Thank you. Your donation makes a real difference. This week, we're pleased to send out two podcasts, this one for Parshat Naso and a second one for Shavuot. Please check your podcast software to be sure that you don't miss either one. In this podcast, Nima Novetsky discusses Parshat Naso. Nima Novetsky is a faculty member of Pardes and specializes in Tanakh. And now, Nima Novetsky.
In Parshat Naso, we read one of the most interesting of the halachic sections in Tanakh, the Parsha of Asota, a woman who is suspected by her husband of having consorted with another man. As there are no witnesses to prove her guilt, she is forced to go to the Kohen and undergo a process to either confirm guilt or prove her innocent. The Parsha is fascinating on many levels. One, just the details of the tekus of the process itself. Two, for what it says about the nature of husbands and wives in Tanakh. And perhaps not in the least, but even more so, the fact that the Parsha is a great example of a unit in Mikra where we have a big gap between what one would understand as the simple meaning of the verses and what Chazal's understanding of them is. For Chazal differ on many points from the beginning of the process to the end, from the way they understand the actual case itself, to the way that they view the role of the woman, to their understanding of the actions of the Kohen, and finally, to the way that they view the men involved, both the adulterer and the husband. Let's start by looking at what Tanakh has to say in its simple sense. What would we have understood the process of Sota to be like if we just read the Psukim straight through? We'll look at the questions that the text raises on both the textual and conceptual level, and then finally compare our read to that of Chazal. So as we said, as we open the chapter, we're presented with the case. The chapter speaks of a jealous husband who thinks his wife might have adulterated, but he has a problem. There are no witnesses. In order to clarify his suspicions, he brings his wife to the Kohen, where she undergoes a somewhat humiliating process. It involves several different steps. She has to bring a korban of barley flour. The Kohen, we're told, goes and mixes some of the holy water with the dust from the floor of the Mishkan. Her hair is uncovered. And finally, she must take an oath that she shall drink these waters. If innocent, nothing shall happen. But if guilty, her belly shall swell and her thigh shall fall off. The priest then writes down this oath, which, by the way, includes the name of God. He erases it in water and gives this woman some of that water to drink. We're told that if guilty, the oath took effect and comes true, and her thigh falls and her belly swells, whatever that may mean. The Parsha raises many, many questions, as we said, both on the textual and the conceptual level. To begin, the whole process seems somewhat foreign to the way that we normally think of justice in Tanakh. Normally, we leave mishpat, we leave cases, court cases, and the understanding of justice and the decisions it's made to men, not to God, not to miracles. There's a famous story in the Gemara of the Tanur Shel Achnai, where one side proves his point with all sorts of supernatural phenomena until even a voice from God, a voice from heaven, a bat kol comes out and says, he's right. The sages, though, dismiss all of these supernatural signs, all of these nisim, and they say, lo b'shamayim hi. No, justice, the legal process, the halachic-making process, is not decided by miracles. Here, though, that's exactly what is done. It's done by a miracle. As Ramban says, "In b'chol mishpatei Torah davar hataloi b'neis zulati ha'inyan hazeh." This is the only case in all of the legal sections in Tanakh where we decide a case via a miracle. The process, even more so, is troubling because it sounds very familiar, very similar to what we might call the ordeal that we know of from other cultures. Jacob Licht, in his commentary to Sefer B'Midbar, traces this ordeal in societies from the time of Tanakh through to medieval times, even to today, and compares the process with that which we see in the Tanakh as discussing the Sota. He points out, in all, there's some type of a case which cannot be proven due to a lack of witnesses. Some supernatural sign is used to test the guilt or the innocence of the accused. And many, we have an oath taken. The test itself differs in various cultures and can come about for different crimes. Often, like by us, the suspicion deals with a sexually related act, but we also see it with regards to witchcraft and even to theft. Often, the test has to do with carrying some burning hot brick, some iron, throwing someone into the river, or in much rarer instances, eating something to see if the person would choke. All this emphasizes our question regarding the seemingly non-Torah-like nature of this whole parsha. What is an ordeal doing in Tanakh? Jacob Licht and afterwards many other scholars, including Elchanan Samet, suggest that a survey of the case of ordeals suggests that though there's a general similarity, Tanakh actually stands out and differs from the regular ordeal in one important area. In most, though again not all, the forms of the ordeal, a person is tested in such a way that he should naturally be found guilty. One naturally gets hurt by holding a burning brick. A tied-up person will naturally drown if thrown into a river. A miracle is needed for the suspect to emerge unscathed and thus innocent. By us, the exact opposite is true. A miracle is needed to find the sota not innocent, but guilty. There is nothing that should naturally harm a woman in the water she is supposed to drink. One might say then that the ritual of sota is perhaps an example of an instance in which Tanakh, quote-unquote, borrows from the workings of the cultures around it, but then changes what it borrows dramatically, making what seemed a very unfair test into something quite different. In our test, it's true that the law is taken out of the hands of man and given to God, but this God is a just God who not only doesn't presume guilt, but mandates that to prove guilt, a miracle is required. All that said, the similarities between the sota and the ordeal still make one question. Why this whole process? Why the miracles? Why here do we not say lo b'shamayim hi, but the exact opposite? Why do we ask for proof from heaven? Another set of questions revolves around what we might call the seeming unfairness of the case. On a simple read of the verses, it sounds like any man jealous of his wife, no matter how unfounded that jealousy might be, can bring his wife to be tested as a sota. We wonder, are there no limits? Can any man, just because he sees his woman happen to be looking at another man, take her to be tested as a sota? We wonder, does the woman have any say in the matter? Can she protest her innocence? A second question relates to the man with whom the wife is suspected of having consorted with. What happens to him? Does he get off scot-free? From our verses, we make no mention of what the consequences of his actions are, just the consequences of the woman. A third question relates to the husband himself. How is this husband who brings his wife to be tested, how is he viewed by the Torah? Are his actions deemed praiseworthy? Perhaps in being overly zealous of the chastity of his wife, that's considered a good thing. Or perhaps he's to be blamed for falsely accusing his wife in a case where in the end she's proven innocent. Another question relates to the actual process that is undergone in proving the sota's innocence or guilt. And that has to do with the erasing of God's name. We know from Sefer Dvarim that there's an isur, there's a prohibition against erasing God's name. And so one wonders why we are allowed to do so, or why that has to be part of the process in proving the guilt or innocence of this sota. Another set of questions relates not to conceptual issues, but rather to the text itself, to the ambiguities, to the repetition, to many of the unclear formulations in the text. Because as one reads this parsha, one notices an inordinate amount of ambiguities and repetitions. To start, we'll look at the presentation of the case itself. The formulation is somewhat funny, because when we first read the case, we don't realize at all that what is being presented is a doubt, is just the suspicions of the husband. It sounds like it's something that was actually done. Let's read inside. Hashem says, "Daber al bnei Yisrael barmatar lehem, ish ish ki tiste ishto, each person, if his wife veers away and she transgresses against him, and she sleeps with another man, and this is unknown to her husband, as we read these different verses, it sounds like this is something that actually happened. She veered away. She transgressed. She slept with someone. It's only when we get to verse 14 that we realize that this is all just the doubts, the suspicions of her husband. He's jealous of his husband because perhaps she has been defiled. Or perhaps he's jealous, but that jealousy is unfounded and she's not been defiled. So one wonders, why is the case presented not as a safik, not as a doubt, but in the language of vada'ut, of certainty? Second, as we mentioned, there are several seemingly unnecessary repetitions. In verse 13, for example, there's a fourfold repetition of the fact that this act was unknown. We read, V'ne'elam b'ineisha, v'nistara, v'hi nitma'a, v'ein eidba, v'hi lo nitpasa. And the act was hidden from the eyes of her husband. She was undetected. There's no witness against her, nor is she caught in the act. Four times that we see that what she did was not known. Why the repetition? Similarly, later on in the parsha, regarding the oath that she's supposed to take, here too we see that the psukim seem to say twice that she has to take the oath, twice repeating the repercussions of her actions, the fact of her stomach swelling and her thighs falling off. Again, we ask, why the repetition? Another kind of question might relate to the meaning of some of these verses. What does it mean that her thigh falls off or that her belly swells? Here, many take this to mean that this is not just a sign, but rather actual punishment. If she's been proven guilty, then he or she gets punished, either by a disease, or perhaps this actually spells out death. An interesting interpretation is given in Olam HaTanach that suggests that Yerech here is a euphemism for the fertility organs of the Isha, of the woman. And what is being said is that now her punishment is that she shall be infertile, or perhaps that if impregnated by this action, she will miscarriage. That actually fits nicely with the inverse that we are told will happen to the Isha, to the woman, if she's proved innocent. Because the verses tell us, v'nikta, if she's innocent, v'nizra'a zara, that she shall be able to be impregnated. One last question, one last textual question, comes in the very last sentence of our parsha. V'nikaha ish me'avon, v'isha ha'hi tisat avona. After we're told that this process has been undergone, that the Isha was perhaps proven guilty, we're told, and the husband shall be innocent of his iniquity. One wonders, what avon are we talking about? Until now, we've only been talking about potential avonos, potential sins of the woman. What sin are they referring to that the man, the husband, is innocent of? It's perhaps some of these questions that lead Chazal to reread the text quite differently than the way we had. Because as we said, their reading is extremely different than what we might call pshat reading. In some ways, they limit the tests. In some ways, they expand it. Let's start with the way they understand the case itself. Chazal reread verse 14, which talks about the jealousy of the husband. They understand it not as a description of the husband's jealousy and doubts, but rather as a halachic process of warning. The word kin'ah, they read as kinoi. And they say, "Ein kinoi ela lashon hatra'ah." Kinoi is none other but the voice of warning. What does this mean? They say, this is actually the first stage of our case. A stage in which the husband is warning his wife. In the words of the Rambam, as he declares in his halachot relating to the sotah, he says, "Kinoi ha'amor batorah, v'kinei adishto, hu sheyomar la b'fnei edim, al tisteri imploni." What is this verse about kin'ah or kinoi talking about? The Rambam says it's telling us that a man must warn his wife in front of two witnesses that she not be alone with a certain man. And that's the first stage of this process. A man has gone and warned his wife, don't go and hide away with such and such a person. It is only after that that we get to the next stage, which according to Chazal is a stage called stira, based on their reinterpretation of verse 13. The word v'nistara in verse 13 is not understood by Chazal as to be part of the doubts of the husband and the uncertainty coming from the fact that this action was not seen but was hidden. But rather, it's a description of the woman's actual actions. That despite the warning of her husband, despite the kinoi, what happened, she nonetheless hid herself with a forbidden man. As the Rambam says, "Hastira ha'amura batara v'nistara." He should tease a term oto he ish, sha'amarla altis tatriimo. right? It's that she went and hid herself away with that very man that her husband had warned her against not staying alone with. So according to Chazal, we have two parts of the case. First, a husband warns his wife that she may not stay alone with a certain man. Then the woman actually does go and stay with that very man. One of the things that allows Chazal to reread the verse is the very ambiguity or repetition that we had mentioned before. The fact that the verse had a fourfold doubling, repeating the idea that the act was unknown in four different ways. Chazal say, Torah doesn't mince its words. I mean, Torah only says what is necessary. They wouldn't repeat a fact for nothing. If this word, v'nistara, comes here, when I've already learned that her act was hidden, it must be coming to tell us something else. And so they conclude, it is telling us that she actually hid, not that her hiding was unknown from her husband. Chazal add one more restriction to the case. The need for witnesses to these acts of kinoy and stira. Here too, they are forced to reread a verse, because as we just said, within our verse, we said, v'eid einba, there are no witnesses. So Chazal say, v'eid einba, to the actual act. But there were edim, there were witnesses to the warning and to the going into the room. By explaining these psukim in this new way, Chazal accomplished something and changed our whole read of the story. Because now, the jealousy of the husband is based on something real. A man cannot simply, due to jealousy, bring his wife as a sota. He must first have kinoy and stira, objective reasons for coming to the kohen. The woman, according to everybody, has acted inappropriately here. Elchanan Samet points out that once we have this real basis for suspicion, we can also now understand what we call that funny formulation of the first couple of verses. Because if you remember, we mentioned when the Tanakh presents the case, it presents it in the language of certainty, not as if this is a doubt. Elchanan Samet suggests that's on purpose because the truth is, the way Chazal understand the case, it is a case that's close to certainty. She is given real reason for suspicion. And so the Torah formulates in such a language of vada'ut. In contrast to, in addition to all of these restrictions, Chazal also restrict who can be brought as a sota. They say not any woman can always be brought as a sota, and actually less 15 women who one would never be able to bring forth and claim that she is a sota and make her undergo this whole process. Amongst these 15 women are included a woman who is blind, a woman who is lame, someone whose hand is cut off, amongst other things. And in each case, Chazal go and try to prove their exception to the rule from the psukim. So for example, it says in the psukim, v'hemid ha-kohen et isha, and the kohen made the isha stand, and so they learn prat lachigeret. This teaches us only someone who can stand. If you can't stand, you can't be brought as a sota. Similarly, it says v'natan al-kaper, that they will put the korban on the palms of her hand, and so Chazal learn, thus prat l'mi she'en lakaf, if someone's missing a hand, then she must not be able to be brought as a sota. Similarly, they say, a woman does have say in the matter. She has the option of declaring guilt and thus being divorced with adik tuba, or declaring her innocence and being divorced with adik tuba, and thus not having to undergo this whole process. And in fact, they often encourage her not to drink, but rather to admit her guilt. One wonders why all these restrictions, why the limiting of the case, why excluding all these different women from being able to be brought as a sota. One answer might have to do with the later part of the tekes, the later part of the process, which involves the erasing of God's name. It's possible that Chazal actually wanted to remove the possibility of erasing God's name and thus limit the cases of sota as much as possible so that we would never have to get to a stage in where we erase God's name. In contrast to all of these restrictions, these limitings of the cases, Chazal also expand the case in several ways. To begin with, the isha is considered tameh, she's considered as if she's defiled, right away after the husband accuses her, even before she drinks. From that stage on, she's asur to her husband, she's prohibited to her husband. If she's married to a kohen, she's prohibited from eating truma. Secondly, the process of humiliation gets expanded in Chazal. By us, in Tanakh, a simple read would have it that the only real humiliating part of the process is the fact that the Kohen uncovers the woman's hair. Chazal add to that. מעלין אותה ממקום למקום, ומקיפין בה כדי ליגעה, עד שתקסר נפשה, אולי תודה. The Rambam says in his description of what goes on here, that they take her from place to place in order to tire her out. Furthermore, הייתה מתכסה בלבנים, if she was wearing white, מתכסה בשחורים. They change her clothing and give her black. ואם היו שחורים נעין עליה, and if she happens to look good in black, מתכסים בבגדים שאין להם, אין בהן נוי. They give her clothing that make her not look beautiful. They take off all of her jewelry. And they have many people gather around to view her, except for those that might be close to her, that might give her comfort. Again, one wonders, why do they add to this part of the process? If before they had restricted, if before they had given limitation as to who could be brought as a sota, here they're expanding. They're giving more humiliating aspects to the process, making the woman undergo all sorts of things. And we wonder why. Interestingly, the reasons might be the very same reasons for the restrictions. One, it might have to do with the erasing of God's name. It's very possible that all of these actions are done, as it says, ulai toda, maybe she will admit her guilt. And if she admit her guilt, then she won't be forced to go through the rest of the process. We will have no need to erase God's name. Moshe Habatal suggests something else. He says, the truth is, all of these expansions of Chazal are simply the flip side of the coin of the way they read the Parsha to begin with. He suggests, if you're going to read the Parsha to mean that there was kinoy and stira, that there was a real basis for the husband's jealousy, because the woman was warned not to consort with a certain man, and nonetheless she goes behind closed doors and is with that man, well, then there's a real basis for his suspicion. And the woman really acted inappropriately. But once the woman really acted inappropriately, well, then she also deserves to be treated in a different way than one who would be totally innocent, because she's not totally innocent. And once she's considered to some extent a zona, she has exhibited some type of prostitute-like behavior, well, then we have to treat her as such, and thus the nivul, thus the humiliations. There's one last area where Chazal differed from a simple reading of the text, and this area has to do with the men involved in our story. As we mentioned before, one is surprised, what about the adulterer? Why does he not get mentioned at all in our text? So Chazal tells us, no, the adulterer did not go unpunished. He too got punished with the exact same consequences that the woman met. Rashi here on verse 22, on the words, Latzbot beten v'lanpil yarech, the consequences of the woman's action, of her drinking of the water, he explains it, bitno v'yirecho shaboel. We're not referring here to the woman's belly. We're not referring here to the woman's thigh, but rather to that of the adulterer. How are they able to explain it this way? Again, this is due to ambiguities and doublings in the verses, because we'd already mentioned in verse 21, the prior verse, that her thighs and her stomach would be swelling. And so Chazal suggests, this verse, verse 22, must no longer be speaking about the woman, but about someone else. Who else? None other than the Boel. One other man that Chazal talk about is the husband himself. Looking at our question from that very last verse, V'nikami avon. What avon are we talking about? What chet are we talking about? Commentators suggest several different possibilities. Rashbam says, it's the avon of letting her become a zonah in the first place. We might have thought that he should be punished for not having watched over his wife before she got to such a stage. And so the pasuk comes and tells, no, you're okay, even though you should have, you're nikame avon. Others suggest that he's nikame avon, that even though he suspected his wife, who ended up being innocent, he's nikame avon. Here, the havamina is that perhaps it's not so good that the husband brought his wife. Perhaps we might suggest that there's some type of an avon in bringing a wife who might later be proven to be innocent. There's one third read, as we see in the Breita in Sota, Daf Chav Chet. They read, V'nika mi'avon, Bizman sheha'ish minuke mi'avon, Hamayim bodkim et ha'isha, Ein ha'ish minuke mi'avon, Ein hamayim bodkim et ishto. They say, only in a time when the ish is naki mi'avon, that he himself is innocent from this type of a sin, meaning that he himself has never been unloyal to his wife, only then do the waters check the wife? There's no double standard. He, if he's going to bring his wife, he too must have the same standard of chastity as he expects his wife to have. So to summarize what we have seen, we saw a description of a sotah and the tekis that she has to undergo in Tanakh, which involved and raised many questions on both the conceptual and textual level. We saw a reread of many of these different parts of the process in Chazal. And in each case, Chazal, in some ways, is attempting to answer the very questions that we raised. Chazal take a case which from Tanakh sounds like the whim of a jealous husband and turn her into a case where there's actual reasons for his suspicions. Once they do that, they're able to understand the rest of the process in a different way as well. Each time, taking their new read and basing it in ambiguities and difficulties that allow for reinterpretation of the text.
Thank you, Nima. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated. Please send your emails to podcasts@pardesusa.org. And be sure to check out the Shavuot podcast, which is the next one immediately following. Thanks again, and we'll see you on the next podcast.